Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I appreciate all of you joining me and all of the comments and emails that I've garnered throughout the last week and even really throughout this year. It's been a busy year, and right now it really feels like we are just in the middle, hopefully the tail end, of this choppy, almost schizophrenic market when we look across the board. But I think that's because there is so much uncertainty out there, and uncertainty seems to be a term that's used more and more, even by the Fed chairman, Jerome Powell. In this weekend show, we are going to be focusing a lot on resource investing, as well as trying to make sense of the big picture through all of this volatility. I'm kicking off the show with Matt Geiger. He is the managing partner at MJG Capital. Matt runs a fund that is very much focused on the resource sector and a lot of the upstream plays when it comes to exploration, more so even some of the juniors. So Matt, before we get into some of the nuances within the fund, let's talk about the recent relationship between precious metals, or gold more specifically, and the US dollar. We've seen quite the inverse correlation when it's come to the dollar and gold. I know a lot of people are looking at other markets and saying, well, what about this relationship to gold? I think as long as we're looking at the US dollar, you get a pretty good idea of what gold is doing on more a day-to-day basis. Matt, give us a thought on why you think we are seeing this inverse correlation really take hold for the precious metals.
Firstly, Corey, it's great to be back on the program here, and happy Canadian Thanksgiving to you. I will preface this answer by saying that, you know, as an investor, I'm very much a bottom-up investor. And so the vast majority of my time is spent on individual security analysis and picking stories that make sense, provide upside, provide value, really regardless of the macro environment. That said, you know, I think it's important for all of us to have a sense of where we are roughly in the cycle and how things are progressing. And it's true. One thing that's really stood out to me in recent months here is the shift we've seen in the relationship of gold in the U.S. dollar. As I'm sure you and many of your listeners remember, in 2019, for mostly the entire year, both gold and the U.S. dollar rose in tandem. And we saw gold break through that key, you know, 1375 technical level in spring of 2019 and continue to progress much higher throughout the year with the backdrop of a strengthening U.S. Dollar. I'd say historically, that's a little bit of an anomaly for those two asset classes to progress side by side. And it's really flipped on its head in 2020. So just over the past 90 days, gold has had a negative 0.93 correlation to the U.S. dollar. So basically an inverse correlation. That's more of the traditional relationship that you'll see. But just as recently as Q4 2019, that was a positive 0.74. So we've really gone from gold and the U.S. dollar rate rising in tandem to a relationship where they're bipolar opposites. What does this mean? I try not to draw too broad conclusions from asset correlations. After all, they can reverse, and these relationships never stay consistent. But if we hold with this negative or inverse relationship for the time being, I think that's telling us that precious metals are more likely to move in tandem with the rest of the commodity spectrum, including the rest of the metals. The rest of the commodity spectrum has had a long-standing negative correlation with the U.S. dollar, and that was also the case back in 2019. So I think for better or for worse, for the time being, this tells us that the precious metals kind of period of outperformance over some of these other metals is over, at least temporarily, and they're going to trade more in tandem in the coming months. But this is something to watch, and of course, this correlation can always reverse, just like it did between 2019 and 2020.
Yeah, I think that's a key distinction or a key point, is that these correlations, especially the inverse correlation between precious metals and the U.S. dollar, it's not a guarantee. It very much comes and goes depending on the attitude of investors. And that's something that I think we need to address, is that when the dollar and gold were heading up together, there seemed to be a lot of fear in the market, which it's not like there isn't fear in the market right now, but gold has more almost tied itself to moves in, let's say, the broad markets rather than to any certain fear. If the markets sell off, then there seems to be almost a short-term rush for cash and gold gets sold off. When the markets are doing well, gold does seem to stabilize a bit better. Do you think that this fear trade that did help to drive gold, that it has dissipated, even though we still have so many question marks around the world?
Yeah, well, I think I've mentioned this on a previous interview with you, Corey, but it's still jarring to me, kind of the shift in investor sentiment that we've seen from, you know, today, early in Q4 compared to where we were in March and April. It's really night and day. And, you know, from people in my network and, you know, friends and family, I get the sense that there's a lot more fear of FOMO, fear of missing out, than there is fear of losing capital. And, I'm not a general market prognosticator. I think we're due for another pullback here. I think the rally we've seen in the broad markets out of the March-April bottom has been overdone, frankly. But that doesn't mean that it can't continue for some time here. So ultimately, I think investors focused on gold and silver need to do what they should have been doing from the beginning, just focusing on high-quality names. Make sure to align themselves with management teams that are well incentivized and working on a project within their core competency, and keep some excess liquidity on the side that will give investors courage to buy, you know, if/when there are sell-offs in the months ahead.
Now that's a key point too, because if you do have cash on the sidelines and we do see a drop, that does present a buying opportunity. But if you're fully invested, then that's when you can really get the squeeze and feel like you're missing out on some moves in the market. But if you have that cash on the sidelines, I think investors are more willing to ride some positions down because, well, they can either average down or invest in some other companies that might have almost that fishing line sell-off. Let's talk about companies, but more specifically, management teams. You said you align yourself with management teams that are well incentivized. I think we really need a distinction in that. You don't necessarily mean management teams that are just paid well. It's management teams that are riding the story with investors. How do you balance that out?
Certainly. So some of the more granular factors, of course, everybody says you want to invest with good management teams that are aligned with shareholders. Quite cliche. What does that actually mean? I mean, I think there's at least six or seven different factors that you can look at to draw a distinction here. The first is the most basic. It's just skin in the game. How much of the company do they own? Obviously, for a production stage company or a multi-billion-dollar royalty company, you're not going to see management in the 10-plus range, just due to dilution and the size of the company over time. But for some of these early stage juniors, it's really important for me to see double digit skin in the game amongst the board and the management team. So you want to just look at how much of the overall company do they own? If this ends up being a big success, are they going to make a fortune from their equity interest? Second would be looking at management's average cost basis. You know, is this team averaged in at a share price that is roughly equal to where the shares are trading now? That's a good sign. Are they averaged in at a price above where the shares are currently trading? That's an even better sign. Or, you know, have they invested at a share price much lower than where we are today? And maybe the current share price, we're seeing a 5 or 10x uplift on management's average cost per share. That's not nearly as attractive of a proposition. You want to be able to make money alongside the management teams you choose to back, not just make them rich by coming in at extreme valuations after the fact. Another thing to look at would be the nature of their ownership. There's quite a few ways to procure control of a given company. I would say the best thing to see is open market buying. That's probably the very best signal. And if management's ownership was amassed largely through open market buying, You've seen something similar with the Cisco Metals and Bob Wares has put, I believe, close to 12, 13 million Canadian into his stock through exclusively open market purchases over the past 18 months. It's been very impressive. That's probably the best sign of confidence in a story. Second best and still very good is that they've come into the story through private placements. So in the past, when the companies come to market to raise money, to advance operations, management's written a check and hopefully taken down 10 or 20, 30% of previous raises. And then the kind of the least ideal form of ownership would be options. And, it's not the end of the world if a management team's primarily incentivized through options, particularly if it's a younger team or an individual or group of individuals that don't have particularly deep pockets to begin with. But generally, that's the sign that there's the least conviction there and kind of the weakest form of ownership out of those three options. Another factor to look at, this one pretty obvious, is recent insider selling. Have any of the insiders been taking profits? If so, absolutely find out why. If there's not a clear, discernible reason, then that could be a worry about either the company's prospects or the company's valuation. Another factor to look at here would be the change of control clause. This is a somewhat arcane point, but I think it's an important one. You can find out executive teams' change of control clauses in the management information circulars, which are filed on CEDAR. And in essence, we've had instances. Kind of the most obvious example was Cobalt 27 early last year, where management teams have had an incentive to sell their company at really a discount price, and it's hurt the existing shareholders, the common shareholders, but it's benefited management. In the case of Cobalt 27, they made a deal at the bottom of the market, and management walked away, I think, with $4 million combined in change of control payments. So the lower the change of control payments that are mandated in the information circular, the better. You don't want there to be a perverse incentive where management's incentivized to sell the company when the rest of the shareholders want to hold and build value instead. And then sorry for rambling on. I'd say the final thing to look at here is other business obligations. You know, is the CEO of this company that you're looking at, does he also sit on four other boards? Is he CEOs of any other companies? How is he spending his time, you know, outside the company? Or is he all in on the singular opportunity? I really think all these factors kind of have to be viewed holistically, but they can all give you insight into whether your particular management team's, you know, truly aligned with you as an investor.
Yeah, it's so important to look at that management information circular. I check that out as one of my first stops whenever I am first introduced to a company, just to see what management holds, how much they're getting paid, any of those change of control clauses. There's a lot that you can glean from those management info circs that tells you a lot about management. One other question, when it comes to management and open market buying, there are some junior companies that even I hold. I know the management team well. They're thinly traded, but you consistently see management, for the most part, supporting the stock. They're in there on the buy. They are scooping up shares at what obviously they think is a good price, but sometimes it can look like there's just no depth to the market when it's only management buying these shares. How do you balance out a company like that?
Yeah, for me, I still view that as a positive. I mean, I would look at liquidity and insider buying kind of separately as two different baskets. And it is possible that there's an opportunity that looks good and maybe you'd participate in as an investor, but the liquidity is just too thin for you. And that's fine. But I'd really kind of distinguish those two different points, look at them separately. You know, for the MJG fund, we have a 10-year lockup on all investors. So they're trying to take an extremely long time horizon, taking it to its logical extreme. And so for us, I'm more than happy to put money into an illiquid name, just because, you know, studies have shown time and time again that there is an illiquidity premium that you receive as an investor. And if you can skillfully get into these illiquid stories, you have the patience to hold on for a few years, you can gain excess return. Relative to comparable securities that just have more liquidity. So I think those are kind of separate questions. Insider buying is insider buying in my mind, regardless of the company's liquidity.
Hey, fair enough. I feel that way too, but I know some people look at that and say, well, you know, it's only the management supporting it, but that's a good sign. Management is supporting it. It means they believe in the story. Let's move over to some of the investments that you're looking at when it comes to the MJG fund. You and I were chatting off mic, and you made the comment that you are not so much looking at precious metals investments right now. You're looking outside of just gold and silver stocks and companies. Explain why, please.
Well, I don't want to alarm your listeners. I'm not trying to call a heroic top here in the precious metal cycle at all. Quite the contrary. I think we're likely in kind of the fourth or fifth inning here. And, you know, it's very hard to know how long this gold cycle will last, whether you view it as having started in spring of 2019 upon the breakout above 1375. Or whether you view it going back to Jan of 2016. Either way, it's been a pretty sustained move upwards. And I think if you just look at allocations of generalist investors, like your average U.S. Family office still has less than 1% of their assets exposed to precious metals. So I think there's still room to run. The reason why we've taken really a moratorium on new gold and silver focused positions just comes down to portfolio construction. So it just comes down to our specific circumstances. The MJG fund at this point is 75%, close to 80% weighted towards gold and silver. That's higher than we've ever been. You know, just 3.5-4 years ago, we were sub 20% to give some context. And that's been a combination of some extreme outperformance among some of our gold and silver focused investments, along with, you know, quite a few investments into, you know, good stories that were focused on these specific metals over the past 18 months. I mean, the fact is that close to 50% of juniors, at least on the TSXV, will say 40-45% are focused on gold and silver at the moment. So there's a lot of junk out there, to put it mildly, but there's also a few high quality opportunities. You know, that said, I think we're pretty well set. The MJG fund will never be a full precious metals fund. I want to keep the mandate a little bit broader to resources generally. And as such, you know, we're more than happy sticking with our existing investments, and I plan to do so. Stick with the horses that I know well. And sell them off piecemeal, you know, if the company wavers from the game plan and or the share price, you know, rises too far above expected value. But in terms of new investments and in bringing new names into the portfolio, we're really going to look elsewhere in the commodity complex, and whether that's nickel or copper or uranium, you know, ag minerals, agriculture itself, that really just depends on the opportunity.
Where are you leaning right now when it comes to some of these other resources and other minerals?
Right. So again, I will never initiate a position just based off of the target metal. That's far too easy. You know, both of us know that in this space, you have to assume the vast majority of companies are entirely uninvestable. And so I will never say, oh, I'm just going to buy five, you know, uranium companies because I'm bullish on uranium right now. That's not the way it works. I will sometimes say I will pass on good opportunities because we're too exposed to this metal or we're too exposed to this jurisdiction. So, you know, I really don't want to make you think that I'm chasing specific metals. I'm really looking at things on an opportunity, you know, by opportunity basis. You know, that said, if there's a few metals that I'm more positively inclined to right now, it would be the metals that have to do with the electrification EV revolution that we're still undergoing here. So the copper, you know, the nickel of the world. And then, you know, I've been a uranium bull for some time. I think our weighted uranium exposure right now is close to 6% of the overall portfolio. So I'd like to get that closer to double digits going into year end.
Very interesting there, Matt. Thanks for sharing. Let's also talk about royalty companies. There's been quite a few new royalty companies that have entered the sector. Royalty companies broadly have been doing very well. We've even seen some other royalty companies not focused on the precious metals like a large amount of royalty companies are. They're focused a little bit more on some of the electrification plays or EV metals, all these different aspects of royalty plays. What are you viewing in royalty companies right now?
Sure. Well, the royalty business model is one that's very, very near and dear to my heart. We actually only own one producing miner in the portfolio at the moment. and throughout the fund's history, the vast majority of our cash flowing positions have been royalty names that use the royalty business model. And I think it's just a better way to expose yourself to the mining sector with less risk of dilution, and while still maintaining that discovery optionality. That said, as you've well observed, and you know, I think some of your listeners might be recognizing this as well, particularly in the junior space, the precious metal royalty sector is becoming very, very crowded, and that creates trouble for both the new companies and the incumbents for a couple reasons. First, you know, each of these deals that are being competed for, there's more and more parties coming to the table and tabling bids. So I would say any competitive process that's being run for a given royalty, it's very likely that the party that ultimately wins will be paying too high of a price. And that's called the winner's curse in auction parlance. You know, the second issue is also competing for investor attention. At the end of the day, royalty business model is really about your weighted average cost of capital. The better these companies' share prices can perform going forward, they can lower their cost of capital, you know, gain an edge over their competitors. But if there's, you know, 40 to 50 junior gold and silver royalty co's clamoring for investor attention, you know, by necessity, investor dollars are going to be spread more thinly. So we do have a few, you know, pre-existing investments that I consider junior gold and silver royalty investments. You know, one of which that comes immediately to mind is Golden Valley Mines. You know, EMX royalty is another one, though they have a healthy amount of copper exposure as well. So we're going to stick with the names that we know, but I'm less bullish on these new gold and silver royalty plays coming to market. That said, I do think there's opportunities that do abound within the natural resource sphere that have to do with the royalty business model. The first is looking at the diversified royalty co's, and there's really only a couple of these guys, you know, the Anglo Pacifics and the Altius Minerals of the world. These are large, diversified royalty companies that receive their cash flow from metals and materials, basically everything but gold and silver. And because they don't have that sex appeal, at least in this current market, as receiving royalties on gold and silver assets, their multiples are markedly lower than their peers in the precious metal space. So I think that's a place to look. I think you could make an argument that if anything, these diversified royalty co's should be receiving similar multiples to their precious metal peers. And I think you could even make the argument that they should be receiving higher cash flow multiples to their precious metal peers, because generally these base metal assets are much longer life than your average 10, 15, 20 year gold mine. So that's one place to look. Second kind of niche of the market that's grabbed my interest is this emerging, I'll call it green metals or battery metals royalty space. And there are really only three publicly traded vehicles that would kind of fit this mold at the moment. But my sense is that over the next 6, 12, 18 months, we're going to see a lot more of these companies crop up. And these are groups that basically apply the royalty business model, but only to metals such as nickel, you know, copper. Maybe you could throw cobalt and lithium in there, but by focusing exclusively on what would be considered battery or green metals. I think this has the potential to pick up some traction and attention, especially from retail investors. I think it's in an interesting way to play kind of the green energy revolution that we're undergoing. The three names that are publicly traded at the moment would be Nova Royalty, Conic Metals, which is Anthony Maluski-backed vehicle, and then Electric Royalty. We're Nova Royalty shareholders. This is not a recommendation for your listeners by any means, because we all have different risk profiles. And I will say we got involved in what was called Battery One Royalties in late 2018. So we've stuck with the story for a while. That's a story. That's a company I've been watching closely, though. They've IPO'd within the past 2 weeks and really have caught the market by storm. So that's a name, even if you're not going to invest, just to follow. They're kind of the first mover and have gained the most attention amongst these green metal companies. And it's going to be an interesting battle, I think, in the months and years ahead as more players come into that space. And then, yeah, very finally, I'll mention that there's also these you know, the renewable angle, so renewable royalties. And there was a pretty major announcement on that just today, where Altius Minerals, which is another holding in the MJG fund, they announced that their ARR, Altius Renewable Royalties subsidiary, had just signed a deal with Apollo Group, the very well-known private equity firm based out of the United States. And Altius has already dedicated $60 million of their own capital into these alternative renewable royalties. And that's basically royalties on solar and wind installations that then pay for as long as those installations are producing electricity. So we're talking decades. And Altius has made $60 million of investments in the space already. Now Apollo's coming in and it's going to put $80 million up to take a 50-50 stake in this joint venture. And, you know, the company's made clear, or Altius has publicly, that they'd like to get this ARR subsidiary spun out potentially as soon as 2021. So that's something to keep in mind. It's kind of another royalty niche that I think could attract some investors, not directly related to metal mining, but still kind of within the comfort zone for some investors that have done well with precious metal royalty companies in recent months and years.
All right, Matt, we're going to wrap it up there. Great conversation. Very interesting hearing what you are now focused on and even some of those new royalty business models. I already introduced Nova Royalty on the show. I'll reach back out to some of those other royalty companies. It's kind of a new strategy for these royalty companies, but we've seen how well and how much these companies can outperform that I understand why you are shifting at least a little bit of your focus over in that direction. Matt, great chatting with you. Thanks for taking some time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and hey, we'll chat again in another probably month or so.
Excellent. Thanks, Corey. It's been fun.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.